European Roundtable for Industry. And my guest today is Ola Shelenius.
Even though I knew the company had been on the board several years, it was not like it was a surprise, but at the same time, it's also a new role. You're not in a role where you're supporting the person who's maybe leading the team. You have to be that leader. If you turn around, there's nobody behind you. You have to be that person. It's probably better to try to move a little bit quicker, even if the uncertainties are out there, than to wait and see what happened. And that is why during these first few years of this transformation process, it almost feels like every year we up our bet a little bit more. We think we're progressive and aggressive, but we go like, no, actually, we need to go faster. We have to look at the CO2 balance sheet for everything that we're doing, and ideally have a CO2 price on everything as well. So the world is moving towards this direction. And in the meantime, we will innovate ourselves into an even better position.
Hello, and welcome to 21st Century Industrialist, a series of interviews with some of Europe's most successful business leaders. I'm Robert O'Mara from ERT, the European Roundtable for Industry, and today I'm in Stuttgart at the headquarters of the original aspirational automotive brand, the three-pointed star Mercedes-Benz. The ERT member at the helm of this company is Ola Shelenius. Welcome, Ola.
Thank you, Robert. Great to be with you and with the ERT listeners today.
Let's get the first question out of the way. Is it Shelenius or Shelenius?
It would be Shelenius if you say it in Swedish.
Okay. You grew up in Sweden, in the town of Västervik?
Not quite. I was born in Västervik on the East Coast, but I actually grew up in Malmö, opposite of Copenhagen, which is Sweden's third largest city.
Okay. What kind of upbringing did you have? What were your parents doing for a living?
So my dad started out as a lawyer, then became a businessman. My mother was a teacher. I'm one of three children. I have an older brother and a younger sister. And I think I grew up a normal Swedish city family life, I would say.
And were you interested in cars?
Well, when I grew up in Sweden, there were two types of families, Volvo families or Saab families.
Sure.
And we were a Volvo family.
Okay.
And maybe you could even say that Volvo back then was the Mercedes of Sweden and Saab was the BMW. So I was already in early ages then destined to go to Mercedes as opposed to BMW, I take it.
Uh-huh. Do you have a sort of a first car-related memory that you can share with us?
My grandparents actually had a Mercedes, and I like to tell myself that I can vaguely remember them driving up the driveway for our summer house in the south of Sweden, seeing that Mercedes. So there must have been some early connection there, placing this the wish to work with Mercedes in me.
An itch you just had to scratch later on.
Indeed.
Well, then you attended the Stockholm School of Economics and you studied finance and accounting. Is that right?
That's right.
What kind of student were you? Were you very diligent?
I was diligent enough, but I used the time at Stockholm School of Economics and later on also an exchange in Switzerland at the University of St. Gallen to do more than the academic side. A lot of extracurricular activities, a lot of associations, sports. So the university time was really a great memory. So I think for anybody who takes over a leadership position, whether it is the CEO of a company or maybe you become the captain of the football team or something like that, you cannot eliminate the phase where you actually have to learn how it works. And then once you get warm and you think about the task at hand.
I'm curious, what led you to look beyond Sweden's borders and say, I want to go and work abroad, I want to go and work for a company that's not Swedish? Because Sweden has a lot of industrial champions.
Indeed it has. But I think it's maybe this mentality when you come from a smaller country where the world is the market and your home market is never the biggest market. So for all those Swedish multinational companies, it's almost like it's clear for you, you're going to go abroad because most of the business is abroad. I just took that one step further and said, if that's going to happen anyway, why don't I just go and work for an international company from the outset?
From the outset, it was Mercedes-Benz.
It was indeed. I've always admired the brand. And of course, everybody knows what Mercedes-Benz is and the myth and aura around the three-pointed star. But I got in active contact with them when I was at University of St. Gallen, and they invited a bunch of international students. What we didn't know at the time, to be guinea pigs for their new assessment center for the trainee program.
Oh.
And that's how I got to know them. And I guess the rest is history. I started as what they called an international associate here in Stuttgart. But 12 months into that program, I heard that Mercedes was building its first full-scale passenger car plant in the U.S. And I was thinking to myself, I want to be part of that. How do I get into this project? And applied for a position in the finance department to start with here at the headquarters. But I then, very early then, went to the U.S. and was part of that program building up the plant in Alabama in the south.
What was that like? You're representing a very well-known European brand in that very dominant culture of the U.S., which is also very proud of its own automotive lineage. What was that like to be sort of the first people on the ground with that project in Alabama?
Prior to us coming to the Southeast, you had already had a trend where first the Japanese went to the U.S. And created the so-called transplants. And then the first Europeans came, actually Volkswagen had been there earlier, but the kind of the new wave in the early 90s with Mercedes and BMW also coming. And it felt like being a pioneer. Nobody had really been to Alabama. We didn't know much about the state. Everybody had been to U.S., obviously, and I'd spent also a lot of time there throughout the years and traveled and so on. But it felt like being a pioneer. We came to this site. There was nothing there. You clear the site, you build a plant, you build up a product. It was unbelievably exciting.
Well, it certainly sounds like a great challenge to begin your career with. You worked in research and development. You worked in marketing and sales. You worked in powertrain procurement, energy emissions management, high-performance engines. I mean, you seem to have kind of really done a lot of different things within the group.
I've meandered through different functions. So in that sense, I've been very fortunate to cover a lot of ground. And as I mentioned, I actually started on the finance side, but I early realized you have to be close to the product and closer to the technical side. So my path from the commercial to the technical side went through procurement. And the purchasing person is usually the wingman, wingwoman of the engineer. And that's how I got into it and then came into production and so on and so forth.
Did you have a notable mentor at any stage?
I've had a lot of good bosses, which I think is a big benefit. And at least one of them, the guy who ran procurement back in the day, who said, Ola, you need to think big. I'm going to help you. So some of them that pushed me along, but in general, I've had really good bosses along the way.
Do you want to give a shout out to anyone?
If I start mentioning, you know, who do I forget? So I'll leave out the names,
okay.
But the company has taken good care of me and given me opportunity to do maybe more than I was ready for. And I think that's one of those things that you have to let also younger management, you know, just jump into the water and let them swim.
That's a nice way of putting it. So that they let you do more than you were ready for and you rose to it.
That was always my goal.
Very good. And was there anything along the way that you were kind of going, I'd really like to have done that, but no, didn't work out?
I've had so many different exciting tasks, so it's not like I feel that I've missed out. Maybe one thing I would have liked to do also early in my career, but it is what it is. I spent a lot of time in, of course, Europe, United States, in England, but I've never actively lived and worked in Asia. And if we see how dynamic the development of Asia, China and Asia has been over the last decade or two, a stint in Asia would have been a bonus.
Yeah, I guess. Well, and it's such an important market for the car industry as well. You worked your way up the ladder. In 2019, you were named Group CEO, the very first non-German to take the helm of what is, let's face it, one of the kind of crown jewels of European automotive industry. It must have been a bit of a moment when you learned that. What were you doing and how did you feel?
I don't know exactly where I was. I was probably in the office where, on the one hand, Manfred Bischoff, who ran the supervisory board, and also Dieter Zetsche, who was the CEO, said, Ola, we have had a meeting in the supervisory board, and we have said you should be the next one taking over. And of course, you feel it's an honor. It is this fantastic brand. You dedicate your whole working life to this one brand. So it is an honor, and you feel that. But at the same time, you go like, oh, wow. It's a big responsibility at the same time. So
for sure,
a lot of respect for what was to come in that first phase when I knew that I was going to be given the opportunity.
Yeah, must have been quite a moment to feel that sense of achievement as well, because I think people are very used to seeing German companies run by German nationals. Chapeau for the achievement, because it's not to be understated, particularly given that your predecessor was somebody who had been there for quite a while. Did you feel any pressure of, I have to follow this person's legacy and set my own vision and set my own path?
There was indeed one German newspaper that asked my predecessor, could you not find a German?
You're kidding me?
Yeah, and the answer was, nationality has nothing to do with it. And I think we have moved way beyond that point anyway in industry, in most industries. Even though, of course, every country has predominantly people from that country running the companies. I mean, that's natural. Mm-hmm. But we're beyond that now. In terms of preparing myself for then starting and actually doing the job, yes, there is a period of time where you try to mentally prepare and you think about it and so on, but you don't really know until you've actually taken over. So you can only do so much mental preparation. Once you're in the position, you have to then get going. And then at times that can feel overwhelming. And I remember for the first few months, even though I knew the company had been on the board several years, it was not like it was a surprise. But at the same time, it's also a new role. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're not in a role where you're supporting the person who's maybe leading the team. You have to be that leader. If you turn around, there's nobody behind you. You have to be that person. So I think for anybody who takes over a leadership position, whether it is the CEO of a company or maybe you become the captain of the football team or something like that, you cannot eliminate the phase where you actually have to learn how it works. And then once you get warm, you then think less about that and you think about the task at hand.
We all agree, Paris Climate Agreement, we got to get this done. Now, don't worry about the product, we'll take care of it. And market forces is making that happening already. But please, governments around the world, work on the enablers.
You came to the role at a time when the car industry has gone from petrol and diesel to hybrid and now electric. And that's quite a transition to shepherd in, I would say, a fairly short space of time. Are there other industries that you looked to gain insights into the factors that help a company navigate that kind of transition? Did you look at other sectors?
Well, this is truly the decade of transformation or disruption for the auto industry. A lot of the transformation or everything that you have to put in place to get to the other side, being fully electric and so on, it needs to happen now. You can look back at all sorts of case studies in history when one technology replaces another technology. A lot of people talk about, what about the iPhone moment? You know, the iPhone comes and what happened to the conventional mobile phone? So there are some clues and cues in looking at such cases. But then at the same time, each industry is its own animal. The industrial footprint of the auto industry, it's not like you can flip that industrial footprint for the world in a couple or three or four years. This is a process that is a 10-year plus process. Maybe if we look at the whole market, not just the luxury and premium segment that we're in, maybe it's a 20-year plus process to get to the end of the road. One thing, though, that I think is a red thread when you read all of these things and you look at, you know, books like The Innovator's Dilemma and so on, it was seldom the best bet to wait. It's probably better to try to move a little bit quicker, even if the uncertainties are out there, than to wait and see what happened. And that is why during these first few years of this transformation process, it almost feels like every year we up our bet a little bit more. We think we're progressive and aggressive, but we go like, no, actually, we need to go faster.
So we have gone through a couple of those iterations where even though we had our mind around the transformation, it felt like 12 months later after having made some decisions, no, we need to make a bigger bet. And that's what we're trying to do now.
I can imagine that it must be quite something to just to keep tabs on all of that and actually make sure that you're calibrating your investments accordingly. And then, of course, not every aspect of this is within your control. If you spend a few hours in the EU policy scene, you constantly hear about the green and digital transitions. It seems like the car industry is probably the most immediately accessible example of that to the man or woman in the street. Yet it's a transition that sort of that comes with, you know, the problems of, okay, rollout of infrastructure. It comes with the problem of the initial technology being quite expensive. I'm wondering, when you look at all of the different factors at play, what do you think is the one that is lagging behind the most at the moment?
We're not talking about just switching over one product. It's more of a systemic shift. From a bigger point of view, what is the problem that we're trying to solve? We are waning off of fossil. We got to get the CO2 issue under control. Who is going to solve that problem? In the end, it's going to end on the desk of our engineers. Mm-hmm. But it is a systemic shift. So beyond creating an electric car, which is the obvious thing, and then moving from customers being early adopters to it being mass adoption and everybody goes for an electric car, other things have to fall in play at the same time. That was also what was behind what we call Ambition 2039, that we said we have to look at the whole value chain. The whole system needs to change here. So what are the other factors? In the background, the big one is an energy transition. So the energy source ultimately needs to move away from a fossil energy source to a non-fossil-based, a non-CO2-based energy source, hence picking electricity as the conduit for that power to the wheel ultimately. I think that's a given. So energy transformation, what else do we need? Well, we need infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Right now, we have petrol stations around the world. I mean, the system we've built up over 100, 150 years, it works. But that whole thing needs to be replaced. So you're looking at grid improvements. Of course, you're looking at charging infrastructure. So what do you need now to build all these electric vehicles? Well, you need, for instance, lithium, nickel, manganese, chips, you name it. So lithium becomes the new oil in a way. Do we have enough mining capacity? Is there enough refining capacity? We're now talking to miners and refiners, something that maybe we wouldn't have done 5 years ago because it was not on the radar screen. And then the obvious thing, once you have the car out there on the road, well, the electricity that you use then to propel the vehicle needs to come from a fossil-free source. Otherwise, it defeats the purpose of the whole exercise.
Exactly.
So all of these things need to come together. And we're trying to, that everything that we can influence, we're trying to have an influence on. Not just our product, not just our operations. We're talking to all our suppliers to follow suit. And we're talking to utilities and energy providers to make sure that for the charging that we offer to Mercedes customers out there, they get green electricity. So it is a much bigger play. In an ideal world, everything would be synchronized and we get this done almost like synchronized swimmers. Everything works perfectly and it looks beautiful. It's not going to be that easy. And
so it's sort of a multi-speed kind of affair, no?
Indeed. And if a few things are a little bit out of sync, let's say the energy transition takes longer, we still need to go for it, so that we pull other industries and other partners with us. And of course, our advocacy is pro vis-a-vis governments around the world. We all agree, Paris Climate Agreement, we got to get this done. Now, don't worry about the product, we'll take care of it. And market forces is making that happening already. But please, governments around the world, work on the enablers. Energy transition, grid, make sure that charging infrastructure becomes a paradigm for every country, you know, set some rules around that.
Yeah.
So it is a much, much bigger transition than just making an electric car, you know, where's the green steel going to come from, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And let me just go back to the point about EVs. EVs are still quite expensive, or certainly the average EV is still quite expensive. Is the reason for that mainly because of some of the different components that go into it? Or, you know, what can be done to make it a bit more pocket-friendly for the average man or woman in the street?
It is indeed true that if you look at the complete powertrain of an electric vehicle, mm-hmm. primarily the battery, but the whole powertrain, if you replace what we know on the combustion engine and transmission side with an EV powertrain, the variable cost of that is higher. Then again, the efficiency is better. So depending on the price of the fuel slash the electricity,
yeah.
the total cost of ownership parity can come sooner than the parity of cost of the product itself, where it will take quite some years, if we look at what raw material prices and so on look like on the battery electric side, mm-hmm. before that gets close to or anywhere close to what we have known from the combustion side. But on the other hand, back to the Paris Agreement, for 150 years, we haven't really looked at the cost of sending CO2 into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So if we had looked at the true cost of using that energy source and we would put a price on that, true price on it, mm-hmm. to now deal with it, I think that from a total cost of ownership, we would get closer to a parity sooner. And we have to then realize that we have to pay for the side effects of burning fossil fuels. And therein lies the key. So there is no quick fix, you know, short term, make the battery electric vehicle cost the same as a combustion engine vehicle. That will take some time. Mm-hmm. But here we come back to this systemic shift. We have to look at the CO2 balance sheet for everything that we're doing and ideally have a CO2 price on everything as well. We're not there yet from a regulatory point of view, mm-hmm. but pockets of that is happening around the world. So the world is moving towards this direction. And in the meantime, we will innovate ourselves into an even better position. So range gets better and better. We yeah. use less of the most scarce and most expensive material, goes down and down and down. We're really in the beginning of this innovator cycle on this. The electric motor is more than 100 years old. It's not, we've never seen it, but there's so much happening in battery technology, battery chemistry, and so on, that even 10 years from now, which is nothing in the auto industry, we will be in a totally different place, an even better place than we are today. And today's products are pretty good already.
We've talked about consumers. Let's talk a little bit about investors. Some of the newer car brands have attracted out of this world stock valuations, last year in particular, much more so than the old guard of established brands. What's your message to investors?
So the good news is our business and our business model as such is very robust. From selling individual freedom, self-determined individual freedom.
Ah, yes.
You can do whatever you want and go anywhere you want, whenever you want. Mm-hmm. And of course, just the backbone of the economy. If we take our premium vans, the package that you order from Amazon or something, it's not going to be beamed over to your house. It still needs to be transported in some kind of a vessel to get there. So let's not forget that mobility, since the invention of the first automobile back in 1886 by our founding fathers, mm-hmm. is what has driven economic growth during this whole industrial period. That is not going to go away. People are not going to move less. We're not going to move less goods and so on. It's a growth business, full stop. The stock market realizes this. That is why if you put the sum of all market caps, established companies and new entrants into a pot, you can see that this is a very, very healthy cake here that is up for grabs. At the same time, when you're in transformation and you're moving from one to the other, mm-hmm. you don't get the benefit of the doubt as an established producer.
You don't?
Not necessarily. I think the financial market has one of these, okay, we're going to wait and see what happens. You can't, as an established producer, you can't tell everybody to go home, close the company, and then you hire a tenth of them back in and you start a new company, you create this, I'm just going to work on the new technology. You have to do this transformation on the fly. And I believe that the capital market is waiting for the point during this decade where we go from being dominant combustion-based to being dominant electric-based, plus all the digital benefits that you also mentioned before. where they can see, they have just as a robust business model afterwards as before. And I'm convinced that we can prove this. And then we'll have to work on the distribution of that overall market cap. That's what we're, that's our game plan. Next to autonomous drive, of course, the connected vehicle, the fully connected vehicle, a thing in the Internet of Things, will be able to do a lot more than that.
You posted on LinkedIn last year about your excitement at achieving the first step in permitting autonomous driving in Germany. How complicated is it to bring that kind of technology to market?
So let's talk about the other technical trend that is driving transformation, as if going electric wasn't enough.
Yeah.
We are now turning cars into supercomputers with very sophisticated sensing technology. We're marrying that to software stacks based upon artificial intelligence. And suddenly the car can do much more than it was able to do before. First of all, as we proliferate this technology, it's going to make traffic safer. I mean, 99.999% of all accidents is because of some human error. So now we're on the verge of, on the one hand, giving the driver a super assistant that can help the driver negotiate traffic in a better and more convenient way. So the responsibility moves from the human to the computer. The product liability moves from the human to the computer, which is, next to the technical challenges, quite a discussion with the legal team before you decide to take it, but all in the interest of betterment of mankind here. This technology is going to grow and grow. But once you've taken that first step, you're not going to go back. You're going to keep on going. It is also mentally a thing. You know, it's a switch.
Yeah, sure.
But what do you get? You get back the most valuable gift of all, time. And that time, you can choose what to do with it. Maybe you just want to sit back and watch the scenery and just relax a little bit. Maybe you want to check your smartphone. Maybe you want to listen to music and browse through whatever your Spotify account or something. So I think this is maybe the most exciting use case that we have coming. I talked to customers in China. What do they want to do? They want to sing karaoke in the car. Could I see myself singing karaoke in the car? Under the right circumstances, probably I could. Not while driving
and reading the text. What's your karaoke song?
Oh my goodness! I'm really a beginner here. So
is it ABBA? Come on, is it ABBA?
I'm sure I could pull off a couple of the ABBA songs without completely embarrassing myself, but. There you have it. So next to autonomous drive, of course, the connected vehicle, the fully connected vehicle, a thing in the Internet of Things, will be able to do a lot more than that. Maybe you want to order food to your home while you're on the way home.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Okay. So I drive from the office to my home and I just say, hey, Mercedes, can you order this and this from my favorite Italian restaurant and please send that to my home? Think about the car then as an intelligent third place. You have your home, you have your workplace, and you have the car as an intelligent third place that can do a lot of things for you. And as far as Mercedes is concerned, a very nice and pleasant intelligent third place.
I was playing Super Mario Deluxe with my kids a few weeks ago, and they noticed that there's Mercedes-Benz. You can drive a Mercedes-Benz in the game. I mentioned to them that I was going to do this interview with you. So my son, Harry, said he'd like to ask a question.
Hello, Mr. Kalanias. My name is Harry. I'm 12 years old. I was wondering, what will cars be like when I get to drive a real one? Will they be very different from now? Thank you.
So if he's already 12 years old.
He's 12 years old, yeah.
Yeah, he's only 6 years away from driving a car. We're deciding those cars as we speak. So they will be phenomenally much better versions broadly of what we know today, as we said, more autonomous, more connected, spacier, cooler styling, much, much more energy efficient.
maybe more emphasis also on the interior. Once you go towards this situation where you have more autonomous driving, then the attention goes a little bit away from you, the road, and so on, and the driver's position as a cockpit, to the whole car being a living room on wheels, where maybe you play games together. If we go a little bit further than that, you know, how far can this go? I'm sure a lot of kids would, I don't know, draw a flying car, whatever it might be. I don't know, but once he has finished his studies, he can then come to us and invent that himself.
Careful, so, you might get a letter.
One thing we have learned throughout the history of technological development, you should never underestimate the creativity of the engineers. There is always something coming.
Okay, very good. That's interesting what you're saying about the emphasis moving from the driving experience to the interior of the car and kind of how hospitable it is. Is anyone in the driving experience department nervous about that? As in, EVs are presumed to be less involving to drive. Therefore, is that whole part of the automotive experience kind of being pushed aside?
It's not really true. If you drive one, you find out that it can be even more involving. In fact, my business car, and during the week, I have the fortunate position that I also have access to a driver that drives for me from time to time. And he is a real pro at what he's doing. Of course, he has been driving combustion-based vehicles all his career. Now that we switched to the EQS, he goes to me, "Ola, I have to admit I was a little bit of a skeptic, but I'm not sure I want to switch this cockpit back to a combustion-based cockpit again." So it's not less fun to drive if you want to drive. The point of autonomous drive is that if you don't feel like driving, you have this option. Maybe you're tired at the end of the day. You really would just like to push a button and let the driving take care of itself. Or as I said, a traffic jam situation is never fun. It's better to give that to someone else. But in terms of driving performance, I mean, we have a performance arm of the company, AMG, or sports cars or performance cars. They are working on a fully dedicated performance platform for the AMG of the future that will come towards the end of 2025. So now we're in engineering of that platform. And I looked at all the technical targets, also the performance targets, the track targets and everything. If you're a driving person, you know, a real driver's car owner, trust me, that next AMG is going to blow you away. So we're not going to take the fun out of this if that is what you want.
Okay. Faced with the energy crisis this winter, what kind of measures is Mercedes-Benz taking to increase energy efficiency and reduce its energy consumption?
So the focus point in Germany is natural gas, as we know, because of the supply situation caused through the war in Ukraine. So what we're doing as a big industrial player in Germany is to see how much can we reduce our gas demand this year compared to before the war. And we are looking at taking measures of at least 50% reduction in gas. How do we do it? One piece is efficiency, but also efficiencies across the board. We have turbocharged our activities on efficiency. Then we're replacing gas with electricity in some cases. And in some cases, we are replacing natural gas with oil, where we have flexible energy source opportunities in some of our operations. And it's about this winter, maybe next, and a little bit longer than that. But what we shouldn't lose sight of is what is the mid to long-term play. In the mid to long-term play, this very rude wake-up call, I think, encourages us to go faster into the non-fossil world.
Yeah.
You saw an announcement maybe from Mercedes only a couple of weeks ago where we're building a very large wind park on one of our premises in the north of Germany. That one dedicated wind park, which we will do with a partner that is dedicated to us on our land, will cover up to 15% of our electricity needs. Previously, we might not have thought about that so much and said, you know, energy companies take care of energy. We're a car company. We take care of cars.
Yeah, of course.
Now you think more in terms of resilience. Of course, you think about sustainability. That's a given. we will put solar panels more or less on every roof around the world. This is not something that is confined to Germany. We're doing it on all our operations around the world, whether it's in Europe, in North America, in China, South Africa. So the project with photovoltaic, we call it the 1,000 roof project. So every roof in our ownership that is suitable for photovoltaic will get it. So we're in a first phase of switching over the energy that we need for our operations away from fossil towards renewable, and quite a bit of the investment we will do ourselves also and produce it locally.
Do you have a regular exercise routine to stay energized with all of these things going on?
I try to do sports on the side, definitely on the weekend, as much as time permits. This past weekend, we actually had the company relay run. I was convinced to take part in that. So one guy who works directly in my team and one of the other colleagues on the board, we ran there.
Very good.
And if you have a goal, then you train more. So as much as I can, play some tennis with friends here in Stuttgart. And of course, on vacation, you also try to do as much as you can.
Final question. What is the best advice that you ever received?
Oh, I don't know. What's the best advice? Maybe one piece of advice as a pragmatist. You don't need to be right. You need to get right.
You don't need to be right. You need to get right.
Exactly.
Interesting. Thank you very much, Ola. This has been a really interesting interview. To the listeners, I highly recommend actually following Ola on LinkedIn because he posts about lots of different things. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This was this month's episode of 21st Century Industrialists, brought to you by ERT. The interview you've been listening to was edited for brevity. I was your host, Robert O'Mara. You can find out more about who else worked on this episode by checking the show notes. For more information on ERT, check out our website at ert.eu. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and tell your friends. We'll be back with another episode next month. Thank you for listening.